How come we don't make lines on the monitor?
We're making very small lines. Do you see?
Ah! Okay.
Ah! Did we just break it? Wait, I think we might have just broken it. Oh, no. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The first night of the second Democratic debates just wrapped, and we are coming to you from downtown Detroit, just a few minutes away from where the candidates debated. It was much more of a sort of duel between the moderates and the left than the last debates, and we're going to cover exactly what went down. And here with me to do that is Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Hey, thanks, Galen. Also, Claire Malone is here.
She is not actually here.
Micah Cohen is here.
He is not actually here either.
It's just us.
We are a bit of a pared down crew today. It is just Nate and I here in Detroit. Claire and Micah are getting here in Detroit later in the week for our live show in downtown Detroit on Thursday, which, by the way, folks, you should come to. Go get tickets at 538.com/live. Anyway, this right now is part of our 538 on the road series, which is sponsored by WeWork, and we are at a WeWork right now. And we are in one of WeWork's podcast studios, which, to be honest, I think might be nicer than our own podcast studio.
Our podcast studio, ABC News and ESPN, paid good money for that studio, Galen. They better not be listening to this podcast.
All right. My apologies to anybody listening. In any case, Nate, what was your takeaway from tonight's debate?
I mean, obviously, the theme that CNN was harping on was the kind of clash between moderates and more liberal candidates. And I don't know that I know who won that. You know, one answer is that, like, maybe the candidates who are neither clearly moderate or Warren or Bernie, maybe they lost it. You know, I was assigned, we all are all randomly assigned candidates, and I was assigned to cover Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and I thought he, for example, had a little bit of trouble finding his footing in a debate where he kind of fits awkwardly in between those two camps, for example.
And when you were saying that CNN was harping on the divide or the debate between the moderates and the progressives, are you saying that they were asking questions that were specifically trying to get that conflict to come to the fore?
Well, sure, because they pick some topics on which there actually are divides within the Democratic Party among voters as well as the candidates. So certainly, if you look at, you know, you have a divide that goes kind of right through the heart of the electorate and the candidates about single-payer health care or a public option, basically. And there are, of course, a few gradations in between. Kamala Harris, who did not debate tonight, is trying to have, you know, basically Medicare advantage for all. So there are alternatives coming in. You know, I'm not – this is not the Vox podcast. I could not give you, like, a 30-page summary of every candidate's health care bill. But Democratic voters actually feel a bit – ambivalent about Medicare for all in the Bernie way, where it would take away most private insurance.
And this isn't a bad thing, right, that CNN was asking these questions. It seemed like that part of the debate was quite substantive.
No, I'm for sure.
Really,
it was very clarified. It's one of the most substantive moments I can imagine on in a debate for a long time. And partly because, you know, I think there really are interesting arguments to be had about, like, okay, well, what is the goal? What are the problems in the healthcare system? Why is the U.S. Healthcare system so much more expensive than other first world countries? What's politically feasible or what's not? What happens if you take, like, a kind of halfway solution? Does that solve certain problems or cause new problems? How do people feel about having their insurance taken away from them? What are the issues of insurance for actual the provision of care, which Warren was trying to get at? These are all, like, really good substantive debates, right? And I saw, like, some complaints on Twitter, like, it seems like CNN is trying to play up all the conflict and all the fault lines with the Democratic Party. Well, sure. You know, it's not CNN's job to, like, make this debate seem, like, really good for Democrats, right? It's meant to hash out issues where there are disagreements, because it's pretty boring, frankly, when you have issues where everyone agrees, and they're just like, oh, how can I tell my cute anecdote about that voter I knew whose mother's brother's son, blah, 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 right? Or sound wonkier, or blah, 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 or have a good tagline, or whatever else, right? This reflected real policy divisions, right? At the same time, for that very, I think, interesting and long discourse about healthcare, people might remember the most memorable moment of the kind of moderates versus liberals divide came on this question about electability. I think that was the prompt, right? Maybe it was, like, after that, but I think it was the electability prompt where Warren kind of said to Delaney, like, if you're running around for president and you always talk about all the things you can't do, then kind of what's the point? which I think is a pretty effective way for her to parry on electability. Because frankly, if you're kind of looking at it in a way that like, okay, who has a resume on electability? Well, it might be candidates like Bullock, who has won in a red state, Klobuchar, who has won big in a purple state, Sanders, who can point to lots of polls showing him ahead of Trump. Biden can do that even more emphatically, right? Beto can point to how he almost won Texas. And Warren doesn't have as many of those arguments. So you have to have a, but you have to have a good response to it, because polls show that voters are concerned about that, right? And part of it's like, hey, I beat a Republican. You beat a Republican in Massachusetts, but okay, she beat an incumbent, which is not that easy to do. But part of it's saying like, look, I'm a fighter and I fight for what I believe in, right? And that comes across as more true to her brand than it would be like citing some poll showing her against Trump or whatever else. So I thought that was an effective moment. But, you know, there might be a little bit, and obviously we're kind of reacting in real time here.
Mm-hmm.
There might be like a little bit for Warren and Sanders of like winning the battle and not the war, because I do wonder if you kind of begin to have a lot of candidates on stage who are willing to say that, hey, Medicare for all, taking away people's private health care insurance, that's a pretty bad idea. And when you hear that from fellow Democrats, I begin to wonder if that begins to pull really poorly with the overall electorate, because it already is like not super popular, not terrible, but it's like, you know, depending on how you phrase the question, and the phrasing is important, a question where you clarify that Medicare for all, a version of that that would take away private insurance, usually that polls at like 43-ish or something
among
in favor,
all Americans.
Among all Americans, 55-ish percent opposed and a few undecided, right?
And if that we goes talked to like, about this
yeah,
on
we
the podcast.
We talked about this on the last on Monday's show. If that goes to like 36 or 37, then it becomes, and it goes 50-50 among Democrats or something, then it becomes like kind of a big liability. And so I do wonder if like on that, and maybe the stuff about healthcare for undocumented immigrants and criminalization of, or decriminalization of illegal immigration, I do wonder if there could have been some longer term damage from the framing that even many Democrats are willing to like oppose these things.
You said that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren may have kind of won the battle, but it could have done some damage in the war in terms of how these issues were framed. Does that mean that you think in that healthcare debate that Warren and Sanders came out on top? Because it does seem like, I mean, the moderates were pushing back pretty hard, and it didn't exactly seem clear to me that kind of one camp or the other, the progressives or the moderates, ended up winning that actual debate.
I mean, they're two different people, right? You know, in some sense, Sanders has an easier case to make on healthcare than Warren, because this is not meant like in a bad way towards Sanders. But he does kind of speak in platitudes, and he does speak about the need for systemic change in society, and that we just have to get rid of the system because it's kind of evil and corrupt. Whereas Warren is like trying to be like a little bit more tactful sometimes, and I thought she had a slightly harder time defending it and kind of pivoted to, I think, an answer that was like very effective, but maybe a tiny bit non sequitur about the provision of care. I mean, one thing no candidate said is like, okay, it's terrible that your friend who has ALS is running out of his benefits, but like those are difficult decisions that you have to make under a government-run healthcare system too, when you're now saying that there is unlimited healthcare even for end-of-life conditions. I mean, no one wanted to go there, right? But those are questions that you would talk about on a Vox podcast or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, was the moderate counter-argument effective? I mean, we basically...
I mean, what's effective is, like, the argument that, like, I am giving you a choice. You can choose Medicare or you can keep your private insurance. I think that's a hard argument to beat.
And to be clear, that argument has majority of public support.
Yeah,
the argument
that's, like,
of
that's a very
Medicare
popular idea.
With no private insurance on the market whatsoever, does not have majority.
Yeah, like I think Sanders and Warren kind of had some of the, you know, better counter responses that you can have. Hey, the system's inherently corrupt might be Bernie's version, or Warren might say, you know, it's about the provision of care, not ultimately insurance anyway, right? Or you can say it kind of hasn't really worked. We're counting on these companies behaving in good faith. But like, it's not a super easy argument to answer. And some of the answers might be very wonky. It might be that like, okay, if you really want to get down to like why our healthcare system is so much more expensive, is because like actually insurance creates moral hazard and all types of complex, very wonky problems, right? And so really just having one insurer where you eliminate competition is where they have more bargaining power, and that's better, right? I mean, look, again, I'm not a healthcare scholar.
Okay, but, so yeah. We've been talking a lot about healthcare, which is fair because the candidates also spent a lot of time talking about healthcare. It was probably the longest single segment of the debate. In fact, Claire brought up an idea on our live blog that the Democrats should have a debate dedicated solely to healthcare because it is a complicated topic that they don't agree on. Let's move past healthcare for now, though. In total, did it seem, and I should mention here, actually, that last time for the Democratic debates, we partnered with Morning Consult to do polling right after the debates were over. We don't have that this time. So we're going to have to wait a little bit to see how the polls come down, how people react. Do we have any sense of who walked away from that debate better off than, or worse off than, they entered it? And again, caveat, you should wait for the polls and they will tell you what the people think. But we're doing a podcast now. It's late. What conclusions can
we? In some sense, we should maybe talk about the lower tier candidates first, because they're the ones that need to get a polling or fundraising bounce to survive, right?
And survive, we mean that in the third debate, right? You won't make the stage unless you're polling at 2% or higher.
Who did not have those stakes tonight, right? Warren is safely in. Bernie is safely in. Buttigieg is safely in. I think Beto is safely in. You better hope he was safely in. Been two not great debates for him. I think Klobuchar was safely in, but I'm not totally sure about that. But other candidates who definitely were not safely in, then I thought Williamson, Bullock, and Delaney did themselves a lot more favors than Ryan and Hickenlooper. And if Klobuchar and O'Rourke are on the fence, I don't know that they did themselves that many favors. Like, I don't think anyone was terrible. And I also don't think anyone was, like, knock it out of the park great, right? But, you know, Beto gets a little bit lost in these things, kind of somehow the answers are okay, but, like, something about his delivery or... Now I sound like a theater critic, right? But I feel like he punches a little bit below his weight in this sample size now of two debates. Hickenlooper seems like he's a little bit like John Kasich in terms of being quite meandering and not even having, like, a style that could ever be all that effective, really.
It was quite an interesting moment, actually, where he, in response to Beto saying we should stop having all of these wars, he kind of made an argument for, you know, it's fine that the United States has troops all over the globe in 400 different locations, which was interesting because in the Trump era, we haven't had either party really defending that view of America's role in the world. And yes, it did seem like he meandered himself into taking positions or making statements that didn't seem to jibe with really anybody.
And then Klobuchar, like, seems, number one, a little bit reluctant to, like, actually, in the way Bullock did, for example, or Delaney did, to stake out a position and say, I am moderate, and you should vote for me because I am moderate and I can win. You know, she makes it to subtext a lot of things. You go, I kind of like it when candidates talk about electability and her margins in Minnesota, whatever else. But, like, I think she has to, like, be a little bit more direct. And we've seen that in both debates, right, where she's just, like, a little hesitant. Maybe she figures, like, I can survive until debate three. She does seem like a candidate who will be better as the field narrows. She is a candidate who is an extremely interesting potential vice presidential candidate. Because she is from the Midwest, she comes from a state where she would be replaced by a Democratic governor who would appoint a Democratic senator, presumably. She has low negatives, so maybe she's kind of playing a little bit for second place, right? But, like, look, Castro was someone who is a very plausible VP candidate, and he went for it in the first debate. I mean, Bullock is someone who could be a VP, actually.
Yeah, and you mentioned the positions that Bullock and Delaney took, which during the first part of the debate, they were definitely commanding a lot of the time on stage, and I want to ask about them in particular. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. And again, like I mentioned, we are at a WeWork in Detroit right now recording this podcast. And from satellite offices to regional headquarters and global campuses, WeWork is designing, building, and operating office space that empowers your people to do their best work. WeWork has introduced a new product called Headquarters by WeWork, available today in New York City and San Francisco, with more cities on the way. Imagine stepping out of an elevator into an office designed to fit your needs with only your name on the door and a building separate from other WeWork locations. With Headquarters by WeWork, you can have an entire standalone floor that's dedicated solely to you and your company. Companies can choose from a variety of design styles to configure the layout to meet their specific needs. Headquarters by WeWork allows you to make a space that's entirely your own with personalized branding and decor. Stay agile as you grow with just a 2-year minimum on commitments. Head over to WeWork.com/headquarters to learn how Headquarters by WeWork can help you grow your business. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Casper. It's the middle of the night. You're tossing and turning, not sleeping, drenched, covered in sweat. Sure, running the AC or fan all night can help a bit, But to sleep really cool and comfortable, get rid of your heat-trapping mattress and get a Casper. The Casper mattress combines four layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. It's softer under your shoulders and firmer under your hips for healthy alignment and extra support. Plus, breathable foams are designed to keep you cool all summer long. With bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to create the perfect sleep environment. Casper has free shipping and returns, so you'll be able to try your Casper mattress for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. Sleep cool and comfortable every night. Get a Casper. Try yours for 100 nights with free shipping and returns. Go to casper.com/politics and use code politics for $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's casper.com/politics, code politics, and get $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. All right, let's continue. And we were just talking about Bullock and Delaney as taking these clear stances on being the moderates on stage for significant portions of the debate. They have not registered much at all in the polls up until this point. Does that mean that they have a lot of ground to gain, or does that mean that people don't really know who they are, and even if they made impassioned moderate arguments, they're still not going to register much?
So let's talk about Bullock first, because I think Bullock is the more interesting version of the two. He's a little bit in that Sherrod Brown mode, where it's maybe kind of a more authentic Democrat version of populism, where it kind of is a little bit hard to place in the spectrum between, yeah, centrist or even center-right on some issues, but also quite left on some other issues, a bit in the Sherrod Brown kind of mode. You know, and he has an electability story he could tell, and he has, like, kind of a distinctive personal style. And so Bullock is one that, like, you can imagine a complicated sequence of events in which case he becomes a viable candidate.
A brokered convention?
We're not going that complicated yet, right?
Okay.
But he didn't start the race until May, which meant he's behind in all these metrics. Maybe he can get kind of the polling up where he gets 2% in some polls. You know, it's not that hard to do that. And the number of polls seems to be increasing as the year goes along. But to get 130,000 donors when you don't have a head start is pretty tricky.
I mean, again, that's how many donors you need in order to make it to the next round of debates.
You know, look, the easiest scenario by which Bullock becomes a player is if Biden blows up tomorrow night or some moment thereafter, and moderate Democrats panic over that and begin to say, we need an alternative to Biden. You know, so it's a parlay. Did he do himself enough to survive until September to extend that parlay? I don't know. I mean, again, candidates don't, like, actually leave the race if they aren't in the debate, right?
What about Delaney?
Delaney, people seem more impressed by. I mean, and he was kind of more explicit, not trying to be like a populist who's ambiguous in the political spectrum, but someone who is like, I am a moderate Democrat, and even though actually not on all issues, I have like my own universal health care plan or whatever else. I mean, he seemed like he was a little bit, especially after that exchange with Warren, which is kind of very memeable and stuff like that, he seemed like a little bit more like a foil to Warren and Bernie, and maybe a pretty effective foil, but also this is a Democratic Party. Voters are pretty liberal. We talk a lot about how voters are like not as liberal as some pundits assume, right? But I don't know if you can, like, put forward a vision that's just based on being explicitly moderate, right? You can kind of have moderation plus populism plus electability, which is kind of the Bullock message and the Biden message, and would be like the Sherrod Brown message and is sort of the Klobuchar message. Like, that combination is interesting, in part because there are a fair number of moderates in the party. If it's just wonky moderism.
Moderism.
I like that. If it's wonky moderation, I'm not sure that's enough.
And to be clear about who Delaney is, he's a former congressman from Maryland, so he's not actually in office right now. And so far, he's been self-funding in large part. So he doesn't have a clear electability argument at this point, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about people who have been
highest office is Congress.
Yeah,
and talking about people who are any conventional sense
who are governors and senators. And like, look, I do think one thing we learned from these debates, and maybe is one of these things we should have known all along, there is an extent to which credentials matter. And then if you have been a governor or a senator, you can talk about issues that affected an entire state. And it's just more effective than talking about a district where you encounter a narrower range of issues. To me, that seems like you've seen candidates with better credentials, I think, tend to rise in these debates, and those with worse ones tend to struggle.
And often you hear governors talk about having executive experience. I have to make decisions, yes or no, on things that affect the people in my state very directly. Whereas, of course, senators can make the argument of having won a statewide election, but still they are one of a 100-person voting body that votes on a lot of things that end up not touching people as well.
Yeah, there are surprisingly few governors in the race, period, right? And Hickenlooper's been bad, frankly, in these debates. And so Bullock, I think, has an interesting argument to make.
Even though Montana is an extremely small state. So
from it's physically large.
Okay, so I do want to get to some of the other topics that were brought up, but I am going to let you pick your own adventure, Nate. So here are some of the items that were discussed, and you can tell me what you think was the most interesting. Immigration came up after healthcare. They also talked about gun policy, which segued into money in politics. They talked very explicitly about electability. So props to CNN for speaking directly about one of the topics that, you know, voters care about it. So why not ask the candidates directly? They also talked about climate change. They talked about race, trade. They also talked about generally why they were running. So of those things, what interests you the most?
I mean, I kind of half trollishly say, hey, electability is a good segment to talk about because voters have a lot of questions about it and voters factor it into their decisions and maybe like voters' implicit assumptions about electability kind of involve defaulting towards saying, hey, I think white men are more electable when I'm not sure the evidence supports that. And it's good for Warren, for example, to make her case for why she actually is electable and or voters shouldn't worry that much about it.
And it's notable that you only said Warren because when we're talking about whether or not a woman or a person of color fits what either the media describes or voters assume, et cetera, to be electable, we're often talking about candidates who are women or people of color. And on stage tonight, there were only white candidates. All of the candidates of color are on stage tomorrow night. So that was, you know, an interesting dynamic. It took a long time for race to really come into the conversation in a direct way, especially given that Trump has been attacking lawmakers of color, given that Flint, Michigan is not too far away from here. But that was definitely, you know, a dynamic at play.
I mean, you know, Williamson was quite willing to bring up race. I mean, it's complicated if you're a white Democrat in today's Democratic Party than if you're kind of asked about race and you have to have a response, and hopefully it's a fairly effective and compassionate response and whatever else, right? On the other hand, if you're like that white candidate who is always kind of quick to bring up issues of race, then that can also be complicated, right? And you're like, who is this, you know? I don't know. I mean, you kind of think about like Buttigieg's answer to a question about race, where he's like, oh, the racial divide runs through me or something, was a very strange answer. And it was scripted, which makes it even more strange. It wasn't like a construction that like he kind of stumbled into on the spot. But, you know, there are kind of problems with that, too. You know, Bernie, I think, was more forceful and kind of saying, hey, this president is racist and homophobic and a bunch of stuff, right? But, yeah, I mean, it was a little weird in that, like, both that and I think there was no question at all about the Mueller testimony and the question of impeachment. And so it was like a little disconnected from the news lately. Maybe it's okay because, you know, sometimes the news is stupid and like,
I mean, I will say to like, the moderators like, of the debate, that first conversation on healthcare was really interesting, even really if it good. Wasn't pegged to a news event. And there were other moments as well where we heard candidates stake out positions in opposition to each other in a way that we didn't actually in the first debates, right? I think a lot of people walked away from the first debates being like, okay, everyone who's running for president is trying to outrun each other to the left. Obviously, that's an overstatement, but there was not that clash of ideas that we heard tonight.
So. Yeah, I mean, and again, the weirdest commentary, meta commentary here on the debate on Twitter was like, why are you seeing them trying to play up conflict? Because it's a freaking debate, people. It's a debate. It's where you argue about stuff. And, like, it's too easy for candidates to, like, lapse into stump speeches and taglines and not actually have to, ideally in a somewhat unscripted way, flesh out these pretty important differences. I mean, Medicare for All versus a public option is a pretty big difference as far as the healthcare system in the United States.
And I don't even know, I mean, I don't even think we have good evidence that a discordant primary causes a party to do poorly in a general election. Maybe there is evidence, and in which case I take that back. But if you look at 2016,
I think there actually is some evidence of it, but you know.
I guess taking 2016 as the most obvious, most recent example, it seemed like the Republican Party could weather quite a bit of discord and still succeed.
Well, Democrats had quite a bit of discord also.
But I mean, we had Ted Cruz on the floor of the convention hall in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention telling people to vote their conscience up and down the ballot, essentially saying, y'all don't need to vote for our party's nominee. That's pretty discordant.
I mean,
is there research, yet, though? Is there actual research that says whether...
So if you look at which candidates or what share of the primary electorate each party's nominee wins, right? And you adjust for incumbency, then that actually has been fairly predictive historically. And whichever party is more unified tends to do better. I guess that was violated in 2016 because Clinton won more than half the vote and Trump won 45% or something. But that actually has been somewhat predictive historically. But there are all types of cause and effect type issues. But like, look, I don't think any of this debate was unhealthy, quote unquote, for Democrats, right? It mostly stayed, or almost entirely stayed within bounds in terms of not getting very personal, right? I mean, I guess Bernie said to Delaney, like, well, you profited from the healthcare system. That was about as nasty as it got, and that's not very nasty considering who Bernie Sanders is, and that to him that's a very sequitur thing to say. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've lived through enough Democratic primaries where I don't think this one's particularly nasty yet.
And I think that's it for now, because we're going to have a longer opportunity. Go ahead.
Let me turn the tables on you.
All right, turn the tables on me.
What did you think, man? It's been a lot of me talking and giving one opinion. Who do you think had good debates?
I came away from the debate essentially thinking there's no clear winner. If you asked me, how do you think the polls will change after tonight? I honestly couldn't give you an answer. And I think that reflects that there was a lot of spirited debate on either side, and nobody really just landed like a knockout against one argument or the other. What I will say is that in general, there was a much clearer argument from the more centrist or moderate part of the Democratic Party posed in counter to the progressive or more left vision of the party. At the same time, the people who were most effective at delivering those arguments, people like Delaney, people like Bullock, at this point in time, don't seem to have a great shot at winning the nomination. Now, of course, things could turn upside down. We will see. So given that, so say the moderate argument in abstract did better tonight than it had in previous nights. Who stands to gain? So it could be those two that I mentioned, but again, like how much are they going to gain? Maybe this is the hottest take of all, but if they made a good argument on behalf of moderation, but aren't actually well known enough to benefit from it, did they make an argument for somebody like Biden or, I don't know, maybe Buttigieg or somebody who is better known, still somewhat of a moderate? We'll see. And
Biden has the advantage of
watching what happened,
of having
and being able
watched
to respond.
Eight different versions of people defending versions of his healthcare bill and can pick and choose now which ones seem to be most effective.
And of course, the caveat to that argument about maybe this all benefiting Biden, the person who wasn't even on stage, I know, don't at me. But the caveat there, of course, is that he could fuck it all up because he didn't do a great job in the first round of debates. And from watching his stump speeches since, he has work to do in terms of succinctly presenting arguments for
the
broader
public. That is the whole question of these two debates, right? Is will Biden f*** it all up? Like, that question, I think, is as important as the other questions combined, given that Biden has rebounded to like 32% in the polls. I mean, if I were another Democratic candidate, I'd be pretty worried about that if I were Kamala Harris. And I would feel better if Biden has another bad debate. And even though you're like, okay, we're going to get a few points, then they'll give him back and get and give. At least at that point, you might say, boy, this guy just doesn't have the talent level to debate well. And that's, I think, has to create problems, although who knows, right?
And of course, if the moderate vote becomes splintered because Biden does not perform well, that does not necessarily benefit moderates, because that could become somewhat splintered in unclear directions. And if they all share
but
his portion,
candidates who don't get on the stage for the next... I mean, so this
well,
is what you're
kind
of saying before.
Potentially benefits Does it benefit people like Elizabeth Warren, who are competing less for that moderate vote in general?
I mean, Warren or Bernie would benefit a lot from a moderate alternative to Biden emerging and lowering him from, even though there aren't lanes, it's all complicated, but like lowering him from, you know, if Bullock gets 5% and that 5% comes mostly out of Biden, then lowering him from 32 to 27, that's a easier bar to clear. So this is kind of what you were hitting at before, though. If Klobuchar had Bullock's debate, just because she's got like a little bit more of an argument, she has some endorsements, she has some money, she's pulling it 2 instead of 0.2, then that would be interesting, right? And she might be the story. But
and
like,
she also at least checks one box from an identity perspective, in the sense that there is a significant portion of the Democratic Party that would be excited to nominate somebody who is not a white male. So if she had, you know, a strong debate, could take up the moderate mantle, you know, has the electability thing, that could be a case coming out of tonight. But of course, the reality is that she did not have Bullock or Delaney's debate. So the question is, who benefits from moderation's punchback?
I mean, I guess it's I can see the kind of hot take that it was a good debate for Biden. It's all going to be outweighed by an order of magnitude by how effective Biden
he actually is in the debate
tomorrow night, right?
And we're going to find out.
If he's really bad, then maybe Bullock was good enough for some money to get behind him. Some of that kind of, I don't know, even as a populist, maybe some of the kind of corporate Wall Street hedge fund Hamptons, California money. But again, that's if he's really bad, and it would be a much bigger problem for Biden, like we were saying, if Klobuchar, or I don't kind of even know what lane Beto is running in. You know, Buttigieg, I think, is someone who has raised a lot of money and is viable in the sense that he's going to be continuing on for a long time. And so if he had kind of made a more forceful argument that would make kind of moderate voters more comfortable with him, I mean, he's someone who I think needs to show like a wider repertoire of tactics in these debates. We haven't talked about Marianne Williamson.
We haven't talked about Marianne Williamson. Marianne Williamson, if we're going to talk about winners, which you did very briefly at the top, and I think you mentioned Marianne Williamson, you can go back, rewind, and check to make sure. There were clear points in the night where she delivered her arguments well. In fact, when she was talking about money in politics, for example, she made a pretty clear argument there. I've gone back and listened to lots of interviews that all of the candidates have done, and Marianne Williamson talks a lot about money in politics in a lot of the interviews that she does. That didn't come out of nowhere. Although she may be a self-help guru, is versed in some of these topics also, including race, for example.
But do voters see her as being someone who is a serious candidate for president as opposed to an interesting presence who was very well versed on some issues?
My take is that if Mitt Romney were president, Democrats would be more willing to choose an outsider with no political experience, given outsider with no political experience.
Because a lot of Democrats
in office,
who don't like Trump, of course, if they can have that go last time.
A lot of Democrats want the opposite now. Anyway, a lot still remains to be seen, given that we have a debate coming up in less than 24 hours. And we are going to...
Fewer
than 24 hours.
Is it less? I think it is less. Less sounds better.
It's late. I don't even know. Anyway, let's call it a podcast for tonight. Nate, thank you.
Wrapping the cast up.
And I will mention again that later this week, on Thursday, August 1st, we are going to have a live show in downtown Detroit at 7 o'clock. Tickets are at 538.com/live. We will not be recording a reaction podcast to the second night, or at least we won't be recording it on Wednesday night right after the debate. We are going to save our analysis for the live show, so we will see you there. My name is Galen Druk. Before we go, I want to say thank you to WeWork for setting us up in their podcast studio at Woodward Ave in downtown Detroit. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.